Today's show is brought to you by Hearst Ranch Grass-Fed Beef, available on the internet at HearstRanch.com.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, and we're broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Brunch is being served. So today, we'll be talking about the Gulf of Mexico. My guest on the line is Tim Fitzgerald. Tim is currently directing the Environmental Defense Fund's Sustainable Seafood Program and specializes in the intersection of environmental sustainability and public health. He is also a senior member of EDF's national policy team, advocating for more sustainable federal fisheries management policies. Tim serves on the Conservation Board of Ecofish LLC and is an advisor to SeaWeb's KidSafe Seafood Program and the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission Coastal Sharks Board. Earlier in Tim's career, he worked with the EDF's Corporate Innovation Program and major seafood buyers to develop sustainable sourcing policies for both farmed and wild seafood. He's a frequent speaker on conservation and human health issues concerning the U.S. seafood market and has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and NPR's Fresh Air, in addition to invited testimony in front of the President's Commission on the British Petroleum Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Wow, Tim. Way to make me feel bad.
How you doing, Katie? It's great to be here.
Welcome back to the show. It's really nice. I'm so glad you could join us today. Your bio is just kind of a little thumbnail history of like the last 10 or 15 years of seafood management policy in a way, isn't it? It's, you know, all of that sort of sustainable seafood programming stuff, which I think a lot of people think of as just kind of newly hatched, really has been under development for quite some time. So tell us what you have been working on most recently, because I know you've got something really cool going on in the Gulf.
Well, you're right. The sustainable seafood movement started out small, probably about 10 or 15 years ago, but in the last, I would say, 2 to 3 years especially, things have really picked up, and now there are just hundreds of people and dozens of organizations and companies trying to do the best they can on this. It's a complicated issue. There's a lot to deal with, but big companies are making commitments now, so that's great. My work the last couple of years has focused a lot on the Gulf because of the events of the oil spill and what's happened after. Mm-hmm. And from EDF's perspective, we've worked a lot in partnership with fishermen to get fisheries management right. And when the oil spill hit, we really felt like we owed it to those cutting-edge fishermen to really help them protect their markets and ensure that their fish was safe and was still being caught sustainably after all of the devastating events of Deepwater Horizon.
So how did you do that?
Well, we worked with them to develop a program called Gulf Wild. Mm-hmm. And at its heart, Gulf Wild is three things. It's a program based on sustainability, traceability, which, as you and your listeners probably know, is a big issue in the food industry right now.
Yeah.
And third, and at the time, most importantly, safety. And these fishermen that we worked with catch mainly snapper and grouper. Mm-hmm. So these are not the same people who were fishing for shrimp or oysters or crabs, which were the industry's probably hardest hit by the oil spill in the Gulf.
I would think so.
But nonetheless, these fishermen for snapper and grouper still had a lot of concerns, and a lot of the seafood-loving public was skeptical or at least curious about the health and safety of their products. So luckily, this was a really forward-thinking group, and they wanted to do something really meaningful and progressive, and so we did what we could to help them, and out came Gulf Wild.
So Gulf Wild is basically a platform in which fishermen can essentially tag their fish from the boat, and then it stays within some kind of a system until it gets right to the end user, whether it's a supermarket or a restaurant. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, every fish gets individually tagged. It's a little, probably 1-inch by 1-inch tag that gets attached to the gills.
Mm-hmm.
And those tags have the Gulf Wild logo, the website, but then the probably the most unique thing about them is that they have a unique identifier in each tag, a number that is specific to that fish. And once that fish comes back to shore, it gets that data gets entered into the database, and then anyone who buys that fish from that point on can look up that number on the My Gulf Wild website and find out where that fish was caught down to about a 10-mile grid in the Gulf, mm-hmm. and also the captain and the vessel that caught it, the fish house and the port where it was landed, the species, and a bunch of other information about the fishing process and all kinds of unique, colorful characteristics about the captain and the boat, et cetera. So,
so it
it's
goes
really
right.
just a way of connecting with the people who are catching and delivering this fish to you.
So, so you have right down to vessel traceability. So you know what vessel that fish was caught on.
Yes, and mm-hmm. it's a little bit of a unique situation in the Gulf because these fish are being caught one at a time or being brought on board one at a time.
Oh, I see.
So it's much easier to handle them in a way where every single fish gets tagged and every single fish can be tracked.
Right, so there's no
if
trawling
something
in the
like
Gulf.
A trawl net or something that was bringing up much bigger volumes of fish at once, this program would be a little bit different.
Right, right. I mean, they do have, I think I mentioned in my show outline to you that that I've actually, I wrote an article recently for Food Arts Magazine that showcased a couple of companies that are doing a very similar thing. I don't know if you know these guys, but up in Rhode Island, there's a group called Wild Roadie, and they use a computer platform called Trace and Trust, which comes out of California, and it's a very similar situation. Although those guys are using, they're using sort of midline trawls, but they basically can trace every single fish has a code, and a chef can scan that barcode right at the table and see who caught the fish and what boat it came in on. Now,
we know those guys well. We've worked with a number of those fishermen.
Yeah.
Trace and Trust is mostly the tracking platform.
Right. It's the,
and then Wild Roadie is kind of the conservation
fishermen.
And marketing layer that goes on top of that. But those
That's
are,
right.
Especially those fishermen in Rhode Island are doing some really great things, both on the marketing side and on the sustainability side.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to talk a little bit more about sustainability, but I just wanted to kind of get into the health of fish in the Gulf. I think everybody has seen on one website or another some of those scary pictures of either dolphins who are dying or fish that have abnormal scales or some kind of weird skin disease from presumably from the contaminants left over from the oil dispersing chemicals. What's the general health of the Gulf at this point? Are there areas that are cleaner and better managed than others or that were less affected by the spill and those are the ones where you can feel secure about eating that seafood? Or would you say all of the seafood in the Gulf right now is okay?
Well, it's hard to say. I think even though despite a safety testing effort that is unparalleled in human history from what I can tell, mm-hmm. The Gulf is still a very big place, and even though the oil was limited to a very specific part of the Gulf, I think there is still a lot of justification for a continued testing program, at least for the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, luckily, NOAA, which is the federal agency that oversees the management of fisheries and the testing program along with FDA, they did a really great job of conducting the testing. I think part of the reason that there was so much lingering concern on the part of consumers was that the communication effort probably wasn't up to the same standard as the actual science effort.
Oh,
and so there was a lot of conflicting information. Sometimes it wasn't really reported in a way that the public could understand. The sniff test was kind of a contentious thing that I don't think instilled a lot of confidence in your average seafood consumer.
So the sniff test was if you smelled oil or chemical smells, you should not consume the seafood? Was that the sniff test?
Yeah, they were actually people who were trained to do this test. And,
oh, my God.
And scientifically, it's fairly accurate. But when you admit to the public that a majority of your testing is based on this, and they just show pictures of lab technicians wafting a fillet of fish under their nose.
Yeah.
I don't think the proper amount of confidence was relayed with that picture and that message.
I totally agree with you, Tim. That would not fill me with confidence.
In terms of Gulf Wild, we recognize that the consumers had real concerns, and regardless of whether the government's program was good or not, it was not producing the desired effects. So one of the things that we felt was essential to the success of Gulf Wild was to actually do our own testing, mm-hmm. Which went above and beyond that of the federal requirements.
So you're doing like microbial testing?
No, lab just testing? Mainly for the oil spill contaminants. So
right.
the PAHs, uh-huh. which are the organic component of the oil, the dispersants, which was another thing that it took the government a long time to get a test for,
mm-hmm.
and then also heavy metals. So we're testing for about 7 or 8 of those different contaminants, and luckily we've found next to nothing. Now, again, these are fish that are being caught in deeper water that aren't as close to shore where there was a lot of oiling.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't expecting to find a lot, but we wanted to make sure that that was the case.
Right. Have you been surprised by some of the things that you've found that may or may not have to do with the Deepwater Horizon, but may have to do with just general pollution of ocean waters?
I think one of the most frustrating things from my perspective as a scientist and trying to look at the scientific and ecological ramifications of the spill is that there's just so much information that is still being guarded or not released to the public because of this whole legal process, right? So,
guarded
so BP
by
hired
BP.
A bunch of scientists and consultants to collect data to support their case.
Mm-hmm.
The government was employing all of its scientists to collect data to try and assess damages against BP for eventual fines and things like that. And so each of these two sides are probably doing really good science, but not releasing it because they're, in BP's case, they're using it for their defense, or in the government's case, they're using it for their prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
And
so, therefore, they can't release that information to you.
It makes me a to know that there's all this information out there that, that can't be shared yet because of this.
And you don't
legal process.
And at the Environmental Defense Fund, you don't have the resources, the funding resources, to conduct the same level of testing that these two entities are. Is that basically what you're saying?
Well, from a seafood safety perspective, mm-hmm. we've dedicated as much as we could to this testing effort. But, for example, the test that I was telling you about before for the oil and the metals and the dispersant, those cost about $1,000 every single sample.
Mm.
If you're doing it privately through a pay-for-service type of lab, now the government can do it much cheaper because they have their own labs and they are doing a lot, but over time, the amount that's getting tested is less and less, and BP is given a good deal of money to the states to continue their own testing programs, but they've allowed it to be for either testing or marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of it ultimately goes to marketing, which is good, but I think there's a real scientific justification for a continued testing program for at least the next couple of years.
I hear what you're saying. One of the things that you mentioned in Gulf Wild, or what I saw on the website, is you mentioned fish fraud. And I heard about fish fraud first when I was doing the story on Wild Roadie. And I wondered, I don't think many people are that aware of fish fraud. And I wondered if you could just give us like a real quick thumbnail sketch of what does that mean? What's happening?
Fish fraud is when you spend your hard-earned dollars on a specific kind of seafood, and either intentionally or unintentionally, the person selling it to you is giving you a different kind of fish than the one that you're paying for.
So you're saying
and
that
so
people
this really
would
became famous in the New York Times a couple of years ago when they went out and tested what was labeled as wild Alaskan salmon from a number of New York City markets and restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And did some laboratory testing on it and found that, I can't remember, 70 or 80% of it was actually being passed off as farm salmon. So
oh,
you're paying for what you think is a premium product,
right,
or a special product in some kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
and you're getting generic commodity $4.99 a pound farm salmon.
So this is the kind of thing that would happen more likely in sort of a big fish auction setting or a fish clearinghouse, not when you buy from an outfit that's going directly, obviously, from boat to plate, like the one, like Gulf Wild or like Wild Rodeo,
right,
or something like that.
The unfortunate thing about it is that it can happen in any size business and at any point of the supply chain. And sometimes it really is a mistake. It's a wrong label gets put on a box, or a fish gets put in the case at the market behind the wrong sign or something like that. But other times it's intentional because there's a lot of money to be made from it. Wild Alaskan salmon costs, you've seen at the beginning of the season,
sure,
upwards of $20 or $30 a pound.
Oh, yeah.
And farm salmon is almost always under 10.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
oh, yeah, I can see a big incentive for
the average
for
seafood
doing
consumer who is spending 30 seconds making their fish decision, mm-hmm, and isn't really going to pay that much attention. It's an easy and somewhat difficult to nail crime.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have to go to a 30-second sponsor drop. Tim, please stay on the line, and we'll be right back. We'll talk more about fisheries management. Thanks so much.
Fishing pole. Some grabbed my hook and they got my bait and they jerked me out in the middle of the lake. Some jumped, I got sunk, baptized on a credit. Fishing down on the muddy bank, I felt a pull and I give a big yank. I hauled out three old rubber boots and a Ford radiator and a Chevrolet coupe. Handed in for national defense. Sitting in a boat with a bucket of beer, and I hadn't caught nothing, but I didn't much care.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
And we're back. This is Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. And that was the voice of the one and only Brian Kenny, the ultimate spreadsheet cowboy from the Hearst Ranch. We thank our sponsors over and over again. Hearst Ranch has been with us forever. So we are back on with Tim Fitzgerald from the Environmental Defense Fund. And Tim, we were talking about fisheries management. I wanted to just touch for a second on, to take a little further, this kind of tracking system that you're talking about with Gulf Wild. Do you see a lot of fisheries going more and more towards that kind of managed tracking systems? And how do those tracking tools help you manage the fisheries? Because what you're trying to do is control populations, right? Or how much fishing comes out of a particular population at any given season. Does that make sense to you?
These traceability systems are, all the ones that we've talked about today so far, all voluntary. So these are things that the fishermen themselves have implemented to access new markets, to help brand their product or distinguish it in some kind of way. But at their core, these are really just electronic fishery information systems, and you could use the information for any number of things, and management is certainly an important one, and we think that this really fine-scale, high-resolution information could be used for better management, for better science. There are all these cool features of this program where you can overlay their catch information over oceanographic conditions, so you could see, you know, where catch is going up or down based on temperature or currents or any number of things. So there's all kinds of applications for these things, voluntary or regulatory, that haven't even been tapped into yet.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really wicked cool. Now, recently, you pointed me towards an editorial in the Boston Globe where two of your colleagues who are working in the New England fisheries area were encouraging consumers to buy New England groundfish, including Atlantic cod. And Atlantic cod, of course, was the subject of Mark Kurlansky's wonderful book, Cod, and it talked all about how that industry had collapsed, which it had. And I guess cod is one of the great success stories of the new catch share management program that is being implemented across the country, but is not fully, I mean, not every single fishery has adopted catch shares. Am I correct in saying that?
Correct. There are about, depending if you count state and federal fisheries, there's somewhere in the range of 20 to 25 of them that have this new management program called Catch Shares. And in almost every case, these are fisheries that wanted this style of management, that voted for it in their fisheries, mm-hmm. and it was kind of developed from the ground up. It's not a system that's imposed from Washington, D.C. or mandated by Congress, but it has been shown in lots of other countries and this one to be a very effective way of kind of helping fisheries to stabilize and rebound and become economically and environmentally healthy.
Can you describe exactly how it works? Because I think most people are probably not too savvy about what does it mean when somebody has a catch share? It's actually a very complicated system. I mean, I had a hard time, too.
If you think of the way that most fisheries are managed, it's usually some kind of open access where there is a season and there may or may not be a quota for the whole fishery that's been set by the management body. Mm-hmm. And I'm exaggerating, but a starting gun goes off, all the boats race out to sea and try and catch as much fish as they can before the closing gun goes off and the fishery is closed. And that's the quintessential race to fish or tragedy of the commons, where the incentive is really to just catch as much as you can before your competitor does, right. Or the fishery is closed. And in that kind of scenario, there's not a lot of conservation-oriented behavior going on because you don't have the time. And you don't have the incentive to fish deliberately to try and avoid areas of sensitive habitat or marine mammals or sea turtles or things like that. So that's kind of the conventional style of management that's caused a lot of these fisheries to be in crisis over the last few decades.
It has the, I'm also going to jump here and point out that it has the corollary effect of depressing the price for said fish.
Absolutely.
In season, because if everybody comes in with the same fish, then the price goes down because there's too much of it. So it creates a glut in the consumer market. And that's another, that's been a big incentive, I think, for fishermen to adopt the program. But the way Catch Shares work, as I understand it, is because this is a relatively new program. It came in around, 2009, 2010? At least in New England.
It's been a little bit less than 2 years now that the program's been on the water. And Catch Shares is really dependent on two things. One is a scientifically determined catch limit. So we need to know how much fish we're going to allow the fishery to catch. And then it assigns portions of that catch to individuals or communities or cooperatives, or in the case of New England, these things called sectors.
Right.
And so it's that individual assignment and accountability that really allows the fishery to become better economically and environmentally. So instead of now rushing out when you know you only have 3 days to fish, you have a secure privilege and you know how much quota you're going to be given for the year, so you can fish whenever you want.
Uh-huh.
You can fish when your boat is in top operating condition. You can fish when the weather is the best. You can fish when the price for your product is the best.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're allowed to change the way that you do business and have much greater degree of control over your destiny and what's going on in the fishery and the environment. And we've seen time and time again that this just results in huge conservation and economic benefits to just about everybody.
That makes sense to me. But one thing about catch shares, which I've heard from fishermen, is that they're based on allocations that are leftovers from previous management strategies. So, for example, if you have a really big boat, or you have three or four big boats and you're a mid or bottom line trawler and you can pull in, and your allocation was X, then your catch share is based on that allocation. Whereas if you have a smaller boat and you had smaller allocations, then you still get a smaller catch share. And that, to me, I think has been a real sticking point for a lot of fishermen who are on the smaller scale. So how can that problem, do you think, be addressed to make it a little more equitably distributed in terms of what your catch share is?
I would definitely say that the beauty of catch shares is in the design. And if you set your goals right at the beginning of the program, you can design a catch share to do just about anything.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Alaska, they were in the halibut fishery. They had both a large boat fleet and a small boat fleet, and when they were designing their catch share program, they said very deliberately, we want to make sure that the small boats are protected and that they stay in the fleet into the foreseeable future, and so we're only going to allow small boats to trade with small boats and big boats to trade with big boats, and no one vessel can own any more than, I think, 2 or 3 or 5% of the quota. So it really put a cap on the concentration of quota into just a couple of big businesses.
Has that been universal, though? Because, I mean, one guy I talked to out on the Pacific Coast was like, I hate catch shares because I'm getting screwed by these big boats. So is it individual to each fishery, like how they set that up, and thus it's kind of a political battle that's fought in that area?
Right. There are no federal guidelines that you must do a catch share in a specific way. That's in some ways that's the beauty of the system, in that these are bottom up styles of management that are really developed at the regional level. And so the people in New England design the New England program, people in the Pacific design the Pacific program, and it is much better that way rather than having it happen at the congressional level or the the executive level. So there's many ways to do it, and every region kind of is in charge of their own destiny, if you will.
Interesting. Just to jump ahead a little bit, because we're going to have to wrap it up in a couple of minutes. Whole Foods has a very much touted, heavily publicized program about their sustainable fishing. What they're buying for the stores now, and Scott Brown, the hotly contested gubernatorial candidate, wrote in that he was concerned that that the Whole Foods decision had more to do with political correctness than with sound reasoning, and he felt he accused Whole Foods of having their quotas or their purchasing decisions based on uncertain science. What do you think about that? Do you think Whole Foods went too far? Do you think they don't go far enough? Or is there more room for maneuvering within their, where their stores are located, and that depends on what they buy for their store? Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, if they say, no, you can't buy cod, then, because they use that as an example of something that they felt was endangered, and so they were no longer going to buy cod. And then at the same time, the EDF is saying you should buy cod from New England fishermen, just because they have a quota and they need to keep managing it. So who do you think is right here? I mean, is Whole Foods gone too far? Is what my question is.
Well, I think the beauty of the sustainable seafood movement and issue right now is that it's okay to have different positions on the same issue, and doesn't necessarily mean one person is wrong. But from our perspective, as an environmental advocacy organization who is actively working on the ground to improve fisheries, we want to do what we can to see those fisheries rewarded once they improve. And as you saw in the Boston Globe, we think having sectors in place now for a couple of years in New England that fishery and those fishermen that have made those tough choices and have started to turn the corner, they deserve support in the marketplace in some way. It doesn't necessarily have to be on a red, yellow, green card or a retailer saying, we're only going to buy from this fishery now. But they, at the very least, they shouldn't be hurt further in the marketplace, because there are some real success stories to tell there.
Right.
Now, Whole Foods is... They're a corporation. They have their own purchasing decisions. They are, I think, truly a leader in the sustainable seafood sourcing world. They've done a lot of really great things. They support the Marine Stewardship Council, and they have two really great partners on their seafood program in Monterey Bay Aquarium and the Blue Ocean Institute. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that help guide them on what to buy or not to buy. So. They can pick and choose what they want to do and what they don't want to do. I think what we wrote in the Boston Globe was less about condemning Whole Foods for its decision and just kind of speaking more broadly to the the seafood industry to say, there's a real success story here. Let's find a way to support it.
Right.
And it could be that in a year or two or three that Whole Foods, through its partners, determines that the fishery has done enough to meet its criteria, mm-hmm. and will begin sourcing again. And I think that's a day that we all would look forward to and would be very happy to experience.
Well, I think their purchasing is probably on a volume that would have a rather significant impact anyway on a smaller fishery. But anyway, with that, Tim, unfortunately, we have to wrap this up. Thanks so much for being on the show. And I urge people to go look at the website, gulfwild.com, to learn more about what the EDF is doing with Gulf Seafood and with fisheries programs and managements altogether. Thanks so much, Tim. I really appreciate your time today on the phone. That was great. I hope you'll come back.
Thanks, Katie. Would love to come back.
Great. Well, I'm sure we'll find plenty to talk about. next up, just for a second, we have Jack Inslee on the phone. Jack is at Bonnaroo in Tennessee, on the ground doing some serious reporting. Jack, are you there?
I'm here. What a familiar voice, Katie. To not hear you in the studio.
I know. I miss having you in there, but it's good to have Joe. He's fabulous, too. So tell me about Bonnaroo. Have you had fun?
Very funny and a very cool tie-in, because I also am avoiding fish, but for a very different reason. I just don't like their music.
You're kidding. I thought fish was the younger generation's Grateful Dead.
Right. Well, you know, I'm not a deadhead. I'm a hip-hop guy, man.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I hear that. So how's the festival been?
Actually, it's cool, Katie. We're here with Heritage Radio Bonnaroo. A lot of positivity. It seems that a lot of people are aware of us already, which is great.
And, oh, I love that.
Something that you might find interesting, they have a food truck oasis, and a lot of local Asheville, North Carolina food trucks. And one of the ladies I was lucky enough to meet, she does a Lebanese food truck. And she actually fought the city of Asheville to make food trucks legal.
Wow.
They were not before she filed an ordinance, so we should definitely follow up and look into that on your show.
Oh, yeah, very interesting. Sure, absolutely. Because we know that, I mean, there have been attacks on food trucks in New York City, and the mayor has properly struck them down. But I remember a couple of years ago when a New York City councilwoman from the Upper East Side was like, I don't want any more food trucks. And, you know,
right,
and there was there was a big brouhaha over that. So you're back when? Tomorrow? Are you driving?
I am indeed, yes.
You're driving through the night tonight?
We are driving through the night, about a 15-hour drive from Yikes. Manchester, Tennessee to New York City.
Dude, well, you are a rock star. Did you get some good interviews?
Absolutely. A lot of good pieces on the way.
Okay, I can't wait to hear them. Thanks for calling in, Jack. And
right,
thanks
Katie,
to
too.
My listeners, and thanks to my sponsor, Hearst Ranch. Next week, I'm hoping that my guest will be Raoul Baxter. He's not a household name to anybody except for some geek like me who reads meetingplace.com religiously. But Mr. Baxter is a cattle industry veteran of 30 years and a former executive at Smithfield, as well as Sara Lee Meat Solutions. So really is one of the guys who is deeply embedded in the commodity cattle industry, and I think it should be a very interesting conversation. We'll be talking about industry transparency. That's assuming he doesn't chicken out between now and then. This has been Straight No Chaser. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. Thanks to everybody for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.